From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Organic seed farmer and breeder Don Tipping of Siskiyou Seeds in Oregon is here for that colorful, warming conversation. After trialing 55 tomato varieties last season, Don has some goodies to recommend and some advice on growing your best tomatoes ever, including ones that actually store well long after harvest. Yes, storage tomatoes. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
Don Tipping founded Siskiyou Seeds, a family-run, farm-based organic seed company, in 1997. Siskiyou is a farm with a view situated at 2,000 feet of elevation in the Siskiyou Mountains of southwest Oregon and features something like 1,000 varieties of vegetables, herbs, and flowers in its collection. I'm so glad to welcome him back to the show today. Hi, Don. How are you? I bet it's not 1 degree there.
No. Good morning. We have a typical high pressure system in January of warm, sunny days. It's been getting in the upper 50s and a little frosty at night. So
you're trying to make me jealous, are you? Oh my goodness. Anyway, I think the last time we chatted, it was about another sort of summery, hot colored passion of yours, zinnias. So today's topic is kind of like that, you know, tomatoes. And you did trials last summer at the farm of like 55 varieties, as I mentioned in the introduction, that I had read about, and I kept meaning to get in touch with you. And so here we are. What was the goal of the trials? Why did you do that?
Well, basically, every year on the farm, I try and pick a few species that I'm going to really dive deep into and learn more about, because I think we can, there's always new varieties that we haven't grown, or people have enthusiasm for new crops. So this year it was tomatoes, because I have a friend and colleague who's been doing some tomato breeding, and recently I stumbled across the whole subcategory of storage tomatoes. So I was wanting to grow a whole bunch next to one another and learn more data, because I find, being a farm-based seed company, the more research and development work I can do is really valuable. Because oftentimes when I'm doing catalog writing, I'll go to many other seed companies' websites, and I'll notice that many of them use the same exact word for word description, which means they don't really know. They're just copying and pasting. But right. I want to be able to speak from my own personal experience.
Right. And speaking of that, sort of that boilerplate, you know, copy paste kind of thing, genetically speaking, or whatever, I always say, and again, as a layperson, you know, I always say a Brandywine isn't a Brandywine isn't a Brandywine, meaning in my you know, non-professional way of saying that the genetics of the seed in the Brandywine packets that I could order from those 20 different seed catalogs that have the copy and pasted same definition, it's not the same unless it came from the same source of seed, right? So there's exactly. So much potential variability, so much genetic potential expression and adaptability, you know, all these adaptations that can happen. I mean, it's so exciting, and that's the miracle of seed, you know? So like, I don't want that cut and paste thing. Mm-hmm. I want your firsthand one, and I want then to get my firsthand one, right?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, a little figure I like to bring up from India, from the work of Vandana Shiva, is she talks about before the Green Revolution, there were over 30,000 varieties of rice there. And, you know, if you were able to look at them all growing, many of them probably look really similar, but seeds do have memory. And if you keep growing them season after season in the same place, under the same growing conditions, they'll do better every year, a little bit better. in that area, whereas most seed companies are just buying from the international wholesale market, and it's not possible to have that level of specialization. And this is what globalization has brought the world is,
Right. So it's availability to all, but it's availability from the same source, which is one strain, so to speak, one set of genetics that's adapted to those commercial fields in who knows where. And it's usually a place that's nothing like where I garden. And the techniques used, it's probably not, a lot of times it's not organically managed, all these kinds of things. So.
When you brought up Brandywine, that's one of the, well, actually two of the varieties that we trialed was our strain of Brandywine that we've been growing and saving seed of for years, and then one from my friend Steve Peters at Seed Revolution Now that he calls California Brandywine, because they've been tweaking it and selecting for production on the central coast of California. So, technically the same thing, but one has learned to adapt to a coastal California climate, whereas I'm in the mountains of Oregon. So,
And again, it's just infinitely exciting, the potential for these living creatures to express themselves, in
yeah.
these intimately distinctive ways, I think. So that's what I love, about seed. I mean, one of the many things. So you had curiosity. You had curiosity about varieties you didn't know. You had curiosity about comparing his Brandywine to your Brandywine, those kinds of things, about the storage tomato. So what in the world is a storage tomato? I mean, that just cracked me up when I saw that in your, I mean, I sort of had heard of it, but I didn't really know. And do you actually have tomatoes in storage in January right now?
Well, kind of to where this the story begins, at least for me, is years ago there was a tomato variety called Long Keeper, and it's still out there, and it's a round red, nothing special, like 2 to 2.25 inch diameter red slicer without exceptional flavor. But if you pick it slightly underripe, like not green, but let's say orange, it'll keep for a long time. But it's not really exciting. And what really grabbed me with the Italian and Spanish and Catalan storage tomatoes was I was really introduced to it through Lane Selman, who founded the Culinary Breeders Network and has done a lot to champion, the unsung heroes of the vegetable world, like reduced stuff. So I actually first saw it in pictures, and she had an artist do some, pen and ink work of these clusters of tomatoes. So it looks like maybe 100 cherry tomato sized things all clustered together like a bunch of grapes hanging up. And then finally, at one of these events, they had a table with the Dryland Farming Collective that sprouted out of Oregon State University of two varieties. One was a red variety and a called Anarita, and another was a yellow one called Pinolo Giallo, which is basically yellow tomato. And so I actually bought a couple baskets of each of those, and you can do seed saving just because tomatoes generally don't cross. From those. And then I also got some from a colleague who has a seed company in Spain, but they're actually in the Catalan region, so they see themselves distinct. So I have, I think, five varieties from there. And so we grew them all this year, and I actually grew them last year, and but I didn't manage to do a storage trial. So at home, I have bunches of them hanging in my kitchen. And every, they're storing pretty well. I'm learning when you have to pick them. If you pick them totally ripe, some of them will rot. And they definitely, the ripe ones in my kitchen became fruit fly magnets. So I learned that's not the way to do it. You actually want to keep them more in a root cellar, a cooler or a garage or some back room that you're not heating in your house.
Wow, that's pretty. I mean, it's pretty exciting because we gardeners, everyone has grown a tomato probably who's gardened, right? So we think we know it all about, oh, there's cherry tomatoes, there's beefsteak tomatoes, there's this, there's that. But this is something, there's paste tomatoes, whatever. But this is something that's kind of different. And if handled correctly, if timed right, and managed correctly and put in the right place, it could mean the flavor of fresh tomato into a time of year when we don't have it. And that's pretty exciting stuff for cooking, I think, especially.
Yeah, exactly. Because anyone who's gardening, we have huge abundance in August, September, and
oh
October.
Boy, do we. Yeah.
But you know, eventually we get tired of it. But this time of year, having fresh tomatoes is really great.
Yeah.
So that, and it just, I think the care of it, I've really enjoyed that part, because you clip the tresses of tomatoes, and then you use twine or string or something to tie them in bunches. So, you know, like, to me, I love the look of a gardener's kitchen where there's baskets of dried herbs and, you know, all the things that you're storing, onions and garlic, or braids of onions and garlic. And this just adds to that aesthetic. And then when you're cooking, it's right there in front of your face. You're like, oh, I'll add some fresh tomatoes to this. Whereas that's a very different relationship than a can or a jar on a shelf in a pantry, which is still food, but it's not as the tactile nature of it is something that is really.
Yeah, it's like a living pantry. I mean,
yeah.
You know, yeah. Oh, it's beautiful. So there was something else that caught my attention in the, and you know, I want to talk about some of your favorites and some of the sort of winners, quote unquote, and so forth. But there was something else besides the storage tomato mentions in your report that I read of the trials. There was mention of, there was Sun Gold, but it wasn't just Sun Gold, which of course is this fabulously popular yellow cherry that has this great flavor, but it was California Sun Gold. And it was there was mention of dehybridizing, the process of dehybridizing. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit, like an anecdote about what is California Sun Gold and what does dehybridizing mean? What was that in the trials?
Yeah, so, well, I think first just a very broad brushstroke definition of what a commercial F1 hybrid is
Yes.
Usually the progeny of two inbred lines. So the breeder, or the company maintaining it, has these two different varieties. We'll call them variety A and variety B, and they look pretty much the same. But then when they cross them, you get what's called heterosis. And it's this is what hybrid vigor is. And then that's the F1, which stands for first filial generation. So every time they produce seed, they have to do that cross. So they're actually maintaining three different seed lines. My friend Andrew Still, who I believe you've had on your
show, of course,
from Adaptive Seeds, he recently was on a podcast, and he was theorizing that Sun Gold has been one of these ones that, for a lot of us, we haven't been able to dehybridize. I know in my efforts, when I just saved seed from Sun Golds, the resulting variety was never as productive or as flavorful. So he was thinking that maybe it has more than two parent lines, maybe it's multiples. And so the level of genetic disintegration, this is why generally people don't save seed from hybrids. You get what's called genetic disintegration by about the third or fourth generation.
So like what we say in very simple terms, it doesn't come true. The seed of a hybrid doesn't come true. It doesn't look like the parent plant the next time around.
Yeah. Like one of my mentors, Dr. Alan Kapler,
yes,
who went by the name Mushroom, he,
yes,
you can never technically dehybridize something because you can't remove the cross, but you can stabilize a hybrid. So he did this with Early Girl, which is a very popular hybrid market slicer tomato. And out of that, a beefsteak, aroma, and a cherry came out of it. So its progeny, it had all of those back in its ancestral lines. You know, this is the proverbial black sheep kind of thing. So with Sun Gold, we've had a variety that I just called Wally's Gold after my eldest son years ago. He wouldn't eat normal tomatoes, but he'd eat Sun Gold. So we saved seed from it. But it's never been that great of a variety, to be honest. So and I have another one called New Mex Sun Dog that's from a grower in New Mexico, hence the name New Mex. And then the Cal Sun Gold, which I got from Steve Peters and his colleague Conti, who'd been in the commercial tomato breeding world for a long time. That one in our trials had the flavor of the Sun Gold hybrid and the productivity. So that's going to be the one that we're I'm dropping the other two, and this is the value of hybrids, because why have three different varieties that are all fairly similar if one is superior? And you don't know if something is superior until you grow it. And you have to grow more than one plant because maybe that one plant was on where an inordinate amount of compost went down or something like that.
Right.
So we were growing at least 15 plants of each of these varieties. So this 55 variety trial was a quarter acre of tomatoes. It was quite a, as I was transplanting that out and having to make all the labels and maps, I'm like, what did I get into? But we really like that variety. So Cal Sungold, it's going to be our new,
That's great.
yeah.
Right. And so that's a little bit of a story of this dehybridizing idea, the idea that you can now save seed from, I mean, you're a seed company. So there's that. And yeah, it's very interesting to me to see that. So just let's shout out a couple of, maybe some old standbys that were proved to be winners again and in the trials, and a few, maybe a couple of other new names that you want to alert us to besides the storage one and so forth that you've told us about. Any other, that you wouldn't be without?
So in anytime you do a trial, you need something to establish your baseline, something you're actually familiar with. So for myself, one of my favorite slicers for many years has been Cherokee Purple.
Yes.
Just as a, if I could only grow one slicer tomato for the rest of my life, I'd be totally fine with that. It's not the earliest one. So I grew that and a few other just varieties that I already knew that I like them. Another one was a Greek heirloom called Thessaloniki. That's just a good baseline for a red slicer with flavor. And then we had a couple yellow ones because they're a different category. So I had yellow Brandywine and Valencia as a, heirloom type and more just a yellow orange slicer. So that I could compare a new variety that I'd never seen before, if it is it as productive as those,
I
as
see.
early or later, or also the flavor, which is highly subjective. And thankfully, I was able to participate in a couple public events to do tomato tasting. So even though I grew 55 varieties, once I was into the harvest, some of the clear winners began to emerge. So I went to an event called Tomato Fest up in Portland, where there were about 800 people. They closed down a city block and we all had booths and there were all kind of activities and, tattoos, like those temporary tattoos for kids and artwork about tomatoes. So I had my favorite two dozen varieties that I cut up and had with toothpicks for people to sample.
Oh,
And then
fun.
a scoring chart. So it was interesting to see what people liked, and it was pretty consistent. So a number of the ones, so there's appearance. If something is very engaging with appearance, I think we're gonna want to like the flavor of it more. And so
Yes.
it'd be interesting to repeat some of this as a blind taste test, because if something's really amazing, striped, marbleized, all kind of unique colors, we're gonna want to like how it tastes. So that's from my observations. And then
Right.
I did it at a few farmers markets as well. So from that, some of the clear winners were from my friend and colleague who has a her own little seed operation, mainly focusing on tomatoes and peppers, called Carmela Bella Farm. Her name is Lisa Trautner. And a lot of these have really unique names, like Gunmetal Gray or Dragon's Eye or Lithium Sunset or Rebel Starfighter. So she wasn't, she's doing some breeding. These are not all varieties she's bred. She carries some material from Brad Gates, who he's gotten a lot of attention for his Brad's Atomic Grape Tomato, which is one of my favorites as well. So, but a lot of the, like the Lithium Sunset was just a clear winner in our taste test. And that one, it's kind of like a reddish orange, yellow, very distinct striped, not like faint stripes. But really, just bold stripes and marbleized on the inside, and a bit of that flattened pleated shape that I've seen from heirloom varieties from the Oaxaca, Mexico area. Like we have a variety called Oaxacan Pink, and there's a few other ones, Tlacolula Pink and Tlacolula Gold. You can kind of, once you've grown enough varieties, you can see, like, oh, this is a variety from Eastern Europe, or this one's from
Well,
Mexico.
exactly. Because again, genetics, right? Like, people, animals, plants, whatever, you can see lineage, you can see a lineage in them, right? Once you're familiar.
Precisely. Yeah. So, like, I have a lot of Eastern European descent. So, I've sought out varieties from Hungary, Poland, Romania. And I've realized after growing enough of those that they don't like squishy tomatoes. They like firm, like as firm as a Roma, but bigger.
I see.
So it, and these are just preferences. It's not to say one's better than the other. But I think, having a seed company, there is something to, we eat not just for our tongue, we also eat for our eyes and our nose.
Yes.
So
Yes.
some of these varieties that are really striking, those are intriguing to me. Obviously, having a seed company where we're using, the website and that kind of thing, it is helpful because, like, we have one variety that we trialed called Uluru Ochre, which is a weird name, but that was like really high in the taste test. But in terms of appearance, it wasn't that striking. It was kind of orange with some gray striping. So, whereas like Sergeant Pepper's Pink, just the name alone, people are going to want to
Right,
try
right, right.
that one. And it is beautiful and it does have a really good flavor. So it's interesting. There's like the trifecta of appearance, the name, and then the flavor.
Right.
And I think only later do people, experienced gardeners, ask, like, well, how is its disease resistance? Or
Right.
how early is it? Or how vigorous is it?
Right. So speaking of the sort of cultural stuff, because I don't want to run out of time. We have maybe 3, 4 minutes left. I want to get some advice. You've grown a lot of tomatoes, not just last year, but over time. Like, are you a 6 week seedling or an 8 week seedling person? And do you bury them deep? And do you pinch them or prune them? Or do you know what I mean? Do you have any, like, what are Don Tipping's top tomato tips? Do you have advice that you want to tell people when they, yeah.
I have a little rule. I don't start tomatoes too early inside because I think they get stunted if you grow huge seedlings and you're waiting for the weather to warm out.
Yes, I agree.
You want to plant any, I think this applies to all plants. They want to sprout and grow at a steady trajectory throughout their life cycle. You don't want to have, start your tomatoes super early, like in February, and then have to keep them under lights or something because it's too nasty outside to put them in the ground. So we usually start them all on heat mats, which helps because they're a heat loving crop. So that really improves your germination is to use bottom heat. And then we're transplanting them out in the field about 18 inches apart in a single row. We're usually trellising using the Florida weave. We use a lot of compost incorporated into the soil to make sure they have what they need. If you struggle with blossom end rot, oftentimes that's a calcium deficiency. So
Yes.
using like some type of mineral amendment that gives you calcium will help with that. And then there's a whole debate. Do you prune your tomatoes? Do you train them to a central leader? I just think that depends on how much space you have. If you're limited from space, then baby them and give them everything they need for the optimal results. But I tend to have a more Darwinian approach. Like you just need to be able to survive here because my end goal is the seed. So I don't re necessarily need like big, juicy tomatoes that are babied with a lot of water and stuff.
Right.
So, but I do think, they're a heavy feeder. So, like all the other summer vegetables, you just think if they're growing a lot of foliage and fruit, you need the soil needs to be able to show up for them and the sunlight. Don't grow your tomatoes behind tall sweet corn or sunflowers where they're going to be not get all the sun that they need.
And do you plant them deep when you do transplant the seedlings? Because they do have that potential to make roots off the main stem.
We use these pots are called McAuliffe was the trade name back when we started them. And they're about 2 1/4 inches square, but really tall. So
Yes.
sometimes it's hard to dig a hole that deep. So we actually will plant the root wad 90 degrees because the plant's fine and then mound soil up around the stem.
Well, I
So
used
it's
to do that
really,
too, plant it almost sideways. Exactly. Yeah.
The tops on pretty much all plants are heliotropic. They're going to grow towards the
Yes.
light. And
Yes.
so even though they might look a little sad when you first plant them, another thing we have to watch out for in this, I don't know if this is a West Coast thing only, is flea beetles love the solanaceous crops.
Yeah.
we transplant and then all of a sudden it's really hot, the flea beetles can be really damaging. So we might even spray, it's a liquid slurry of kale and clay. And so then it's kind of a white clay.
Sure.
Guess that just the flea beetles don't like that. So that's
Yeah.
one little trick we'll do. Or we might do a foliar spray of fish emulsion and kelp just to help get them growing early.
Yes.
So those are a
Well,
couple of our tricks we do.
great. Well, I'm so glad we talked about tomatoes, especially again since it was 1 degree this morning
Yeah.
when I woke up. And Don, I'm just going to say you're just a natural born teacher, and there's so much good information. I'll give links and stuff so forth on your website, and you do on farm training and all kinds of other teaching. And it's just I always learn from you, and I'm so appreciative. And the Siskiyou offerings are just incredible. So I'm excited to turn people on to some more of them. And it's been fun to talk to you again. Thank you so much for making time today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you again soon, I hope. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening, including with tomatoes, meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com.